and it's D. Fried Dudley from St. George, South Carolina.
Thank you. This is what I've decided to say, and the people that love me have told me some other things to say. Thank God there's some people here tonight who haven't heard me. There's so many that have, and so many people here that love me and cared for me through my recovery this far. I feel like a fellow that took about 16 years to get through college, and then suddenly he's employed by his professors or something. I look around, I see Bob and Joe Clements and Cornel and Tom and Lib and Ferris and Frank and Harry and all the rest of you that have been so instrumental in my getting this far. I got to tell the truth. Virgil's sitting up front, and he said that if I got off the beaten path and raised his fingers, I should retract the last three sentences and start over. But I'd like to thank everybody who was responsible for inviting Evelyn and I. We appreciate the opportunity to be with you. Just a short time ago, I went in the office one morning. There's a little note that I called Lillian, and I thought perhaps she wanted some advice on how Cornel and I were running things down in Myrtle Beach, you know, to get things straightened out up here. And she said, no, they had all the advice they wanted. Just wondered if I'd come talk, and I said, well, certainly. I appreciated that. Lillian is a very lovely person. If you haven't known Lillian, I've known her since I've been in AA, along with Frank and Ferris. They were the first three people I knew from this area. And we got together real early at St. Simon's when I was 11 months sober, and they displayed a great deal of happiness and joy with being in AA. And so I have been a little heartbroken that Lillian wasn't here, but I love her dearly, and she's a very lovely person. And Joe and Mrs. Arnold are here, and I'm sure that they will tell Lillian that I do love her, and we miss her so much. And after Lillian wasn't here, we got here, and Ferris wasn't here. We just called them, told them they have to come on over. That's all about that. Well, we appreciate being asked, and we thank you for coming and for being our friends. I feel real grateful and right humble, and if I can get 12 of the people together that helped me a great deal after the meeting, I'll probably wash their feet. And there's a lot of people here tonight who represent a lot of areas of the country. A lot of people here tonight that could be responsible when you go back home to helping the suffering alcoholic. There is help for the alcoholic. We know this in this program. It's been, I'm living witness of that. There's help. There used to not be help for the alcoholic, you know. It reminds me of the two boys down home. They went fishing, and they were sitting on a log fishing, and a snake crawled up behind one and bit him right on the back end. And he panicked. He said, I'm going to die. Bill, run, get the doctor, and tell him to come down here quick. And Bill went to get the doctor, and the doctor told him, you just go back and bring your friend here to me, and he'll be all right. But when you get back down there, take this razor blade and cut, make a cross mark where the snake bit him, and suck the poison out of it and bring him onto the office, and he'll be okay. Bill went walking back down in the woods, just casually whistling, you know, and his buddy heard him. He said, hey, Bill, come on over here and tell me what the doctor said. And Bill said, the doctor said to tell you there ain't nothing us can do for you. So if you are an alcoholic and you know somebody that needs help, there's help for the alcoholic and help for people that need it. We exempted a portion of the usual program this while ago by not praying together the Serenity Prayer, but of course that's forgivable. And but it says in that wisdom to know the difference, you know. Wisdom to know the difference. There was a man and his son paddling down a river in Africa, and they were cannibals, and riding down in the boat, you know, and they rounded a curve, and looking, there's this pretty girl, you know, kind of like Evelyn standing there in the water.
washing and taking a bath, and the boy looked at his daddy and said, "Golly, look up there. Daddy, let's catch her and carry her home and cook her." Daddy said, "No, let's catch her and carry her home and cook your mama, you know." wisdom to know the difference. I've gained some wisdom in the program. I've been able to know what to do from time to time when it was necessary for me to make a decision. This is a result of being in the program of AA. And of course, AA is my medicine. I advocate and advise anybody that has the illness of alcoholism to take the proper medication. I mean, it's just that simple. If it's an illness, you need medication, and you should. And AA is my medicine. I have been thoroughly enthused and pleased and satisfied with AA ever since I came in. I've never been disappointed with it. At times, I didn't like it, you know. But I've always enjoyed AA, the medicine for the illness of my alcoholism. No, I don't get tired of it. Old boy down home went to the doctor one time, and probably like Bill up in, and the doctor gave him some medicine and told him to take it 3 days running and skip a day. And he come back in a week time. Doc said, "Well, how you feel?" He said, "Well, I'm real tired, you know, taking 3 days running and skip a day. That's pretty strenuous physically, but I've skipped some days since I've been at AA, and but God has continued to bless me with sobriety. And I'm gonna get into my story now, but before I do that, I want to tell you that I'm so self-centered, egotistical, that you probably think that I had something to do with my getting sober before I'm finished, and I did not. It was God who did it, and I want him to have the credit. I'm Dupree Westbury, and I'm an alcoholic, and I'm a Class A drug addict, narcotics addict. I'm also a barbiturate addict, and an amphetamine addict, and a tranquilizer addict, and I drank Vitalis hair tonic. For what it's worth, to those of you who thought maybe I wouldn't make it, I came in 1964. And I'm a member of the Walter Burr St. George group. It was the Walter Burr group when I joined. And I got to be the GSR, and we changed that to the Walter Burr St. George group because I'm from St. George. And I didn't think it would be nice to continue, you know, just the Walter Burr group. I mean, the only thing I had to do was just threaten to take everybody out of the group that would follow me and carry them back to St. George and form my own group. And they came across. Changed the name. But I am grateful tonight, and especially after what we heard this morning. I think we had a beautiful program here this morning, a very simple and truthful program, a witness of recovery of the entire family, so beautifully put, and in such a nice time period, you know. Three good speakers, an hour and a half. And see, I use an hour and a half and you know, and won't say nearly all the things that I want to say. I thought that was real nice. I am grateful. I'm grateful to those I can see right in front of me who love me enough to stand on my feet and tell me what I needed to know and to do. I get to talk in a lot of schools and churches and prisons, and I thank God for this. And, you know, I tell these kids, I said, you're learning in school a lot of things that you ought to know, but there are some things that you need to know, you know. And there's a vast difference in this. People like Cornelia, you know, after I'd been in AA 3 months and I was returning to somewhat a normal physical condition, I said, mentioned to him one night down at John Mooney's that I just might get me a trailer and put down on the lake, and in case some of my friends come down there, I'd have a place to take them. He said, "No, you don't want to do that. I know what you're fixing to do, boy. You're fixing to get involved in the wrong type of fellowship, so you can't do that. You get drunk." You know, and he went on and he told me what would happen. And people in the very beginning that loved me enough to tell me the things that I needed to know. And you know what? I had enough courage to do most of it. I thank God for this. So I'm real grateful to all of you. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship. This is the first message we get from the preamble. Many people ask what it is. It's difficult
to say what it is, but this is it. It is a fellowship, and this is the Pine Mountain Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a fellowship. People who care and share. People who care about one another. And then people who share with one another. We are the people who understand. And because we understand, we love. And if we don't understand, we have the compassion to love until we do understand. So we are the people. We are the people that must do God's will and carry this message to the suffering alcoholic. And if you're in AA and you aren't happy, it's very possible that you haven't been doing what the instructions say. Try to stay sober and carry the message to the alcoholic. It's a fellowship. Do you know what a fellowship is? Certainly you do. But you can get hooked on this. Gary just said that this was growing. Last year, 125. This year, 205. Next year, 265. Why? Because people love fellowship. You know? This couple down home retired and went out in the country to raise hogs. And they bought them a mama hog and put the hog in the pen. And every morning, the man would go out and look in the pen to see if he had any little hogs. And he never did have no little hogs. So he told his wife one day, he said, well, we'd better take this old sow to the veterinarian. And they did. And got down there to the veterinarian, and the veterinarian said, well, I tell you what's wrong. What she needs is some fellowship. See? So she went back home and put the sow in the wheelbarrow, and she took her down the road to the Joneses and for fellowship and brought her back and put her in the pen. Went out there the next morning, and no little hog. He put her back in the wheelbarrow and went down to the road to the smith for fellowship and brought her back and put her in the pen. Next morning, he wasn't quite ready yet, and he asked his wife to go out and check on the mama hog. And she went out, came back in the house, and he says, well, he said, honey, we don't have any little hogs, but the old sow's in the wheelbarrow ready to go. So, you know. So if you're having trouble getting somebody to come to a meeting, you know, we never did want to come. I didn't want to come to AA. But after I came here, and after I got to ride in the wheelbarrow a while, I wanted to come back to my next meeting, you know. So if you can get them to ride in the wheelbarrow for just a little while, they'll keep coming back. Because you cannot deny the love and the understanding that is available at AA meetings. There's just no denying this. And it'll get through to anybody because it got through to me. The first time I took a drink, I got drunk and thought I was a red-eyed Eddie Stowe Indian. There ain't no such tribe in South Carolina. I beat on my chest and paraded around at 16 years of age and said, I am a red-eyed Eddie Stowe Indian. And for 3 days after, I was feeling bad and, you know, hungover and everything. And they told me, you know, they told me if I hadn't mixed all of these drinks that I wouldn't have got sick and drunk. They didn't tell me that alcohol done it. They said them mixed drinks done it, you know. I had trouble with alcohol then from the very beginning. I have the opportunity to talk in schools where there's a great deal of young people, you know, like in the private schools and the public schools and places like that. I appreciate this opportunity. And I try to stress to these young people in particular the adversity that they can get in from the use of alcohol. You know, they say, oh, it doesn't worry me. It doesn't hurt me. It does from the very beginning. You take any young boy, he'll start raking leaves in October and rake leaves and clean up around people's houses and do all manner of things to make some money so when Christmas time comes, he can go down to the store and buy this pretty little girl some perfume and come to a house like mine. Somebody's got pretty little girls, and knock on the door, and she'll come out and receive the perfume and go back in the room and put it wherever girls put it and come back out and smell real good. And she's pretty, and he's pretty, and they both go out of the front door together and go downtown, see? And he'll take her down to the Red Rooster and drink 4 cans of Budweiser and puke on the same girl before 10 o'clock. And then people say, well, then there's no problem with me. It is a problem from the very beginning.
So it was with me. Problem from the very beginning.
Unmanageable life. I didn't even recognize who I was. I thought I was the red-eyed Ed Still Indian. Changed me completely.
I did learn to drink, though. I did learn how maybe to drink, and then when I had hangovers, people said, well, don't worry about it. It was just your system was out of order. Never did say it was the alcohol. Never did say that. Wasn't any need for me to quit drinking in the beginning, you know. Wasn't any need to stop. There has to be a need for us to quit. And like somebody has said here this weekend, we drink usually 3 or 4 years beyond this period when we should have stopped, when we should have gotten help. And I did that. I was in World War II, and I didn't do anything to make it any longer or any shorter. I was just one of 16 million. In fact, I was drinking the whole time the war was going on and after the war until a period not long ago when I was visiting my sponsor, and I looked in his living room, and he had medals hanging up in the living room that was quite attractive. And me being a good alcoholic, you know, I said, well, where'd you get them? He said, them's World War II medals. I said, well, God, I didn't get mine. They didn't give me none like that. And I was in the big war. He said, yeah, you got the right for them. I said, well, God, I just got sober. I never had thought of that. Didn't know it, you know. So I rode off and got my medals, you know. And the other day I come home and them little blue boxes were stacked up there on the table, and it was dinner time. And obviously opened them things, and there them pretty medals were. And guess what? I put them on for dinner that evening. And Darlene said, Daddy, what's that one there for? That prettiest one, you know. I said, that's for being in the big war. She said, well, I should have known that. You wouldn't have been in nothing but the biggest one. You know? Things like that. Came home after the war and drank. Drinking became a part of my life. I could do things when I was drinking that I wanted to do that I wouldn't do otherwise, you know. Like go out with the girls and dance. I like girls, man. I'm telling you the truth, man. I loved them. You get one of them and hug them up close to you in them little old soft sweaters and everything, and golly, they were nice. And I like that part. And I like it better yet because they're so much nicer sober, you know, when you can taste them right and everything. And I drank, and this became a way of life for me. And down home, you know, these girls, you know, would tell us, if you want what we have, there are certain things you'll have to do. Kind of like, you know, and I wanted what they had. And we'd go off and have these parties and get drunk and, you know, stay out and do these things. And then I'd go to church the next morning, and I was a Baptist, and we've heard some remarks about that during this weekend. And then I'd be sitting there, and I'd be looking, you know, and the preacher would say, and if you do so and so, you'll die and burn and go to hell. And I had just quit doing it. I had just quit doing that about 4, 5, 6 hours ago. So it got so uncomfortable for me in the Baptist church. Down, I don't know about up here, but down home, the Baptists are kind of like, hey, they ain't for or against a damn thing. If you do anything, you're going to hell, that's it, man. No marginal thing, no way. You have had it. And I was gifted. So I had to quit going to that church. I couldn't go there. Now, who wants to go and worship somebody that's about to burn them up, huh? I didn't want that. I couldn't go that far. I used to lie awake at night thinking about things I had done and things maybe that I should do. I've wondered about this spiritual experience people told me about, my folks. My granddaddy, you know, he was a Baptist. My grandmama was one, and they wouldn't do nothing to the church unless they checked with them. And had uncle, bless his soul, gave the ultimate. You know, he died teaching the Sunday school class. This is as high as you can get in the Baptist church. They were all perfect, and there I was drinking liquor and committing a little light adultery and doing these things that I ought not be doing. y'all told me to tell the truth.
I wasn't comfortable with me. But when I drank, I could forget these things, you know. I could forget. So I used alcohol. And I drank for a number of years. A number of years. And then there came a time in my life when I didn't want to drink anymore. I had gotten married, and we had had a little son born. And we had a pretty little daughter born. And I had a family to go home to. And I loved them. And I'm like C.D. says, anybody that says an alcoholic doesn't love their family is a lie. I usually say a damn lie, but Virginia asked me not to say damn. And so I tried to do this too. This is a lie. I loved them. But, you know, I'd get that old hurting in my gut. You know, if this is an illness, there's got to be some symptoms. And I'd feel bad and seem like if I could go by the liquor store and get me a drink, then, I could kind of get normal again, you know. And boy, I'd get so normal, sometime I wouldn't even get home. And then when I got home, I'd be so normal I couldn't get in bed. And then I would become violent. Character-changing drug, alcohol, character-changing drug, you know. Got way I didn't remember what I did and who I did it to. Like Doc said the other night, you know, you can't pick out where you're going to pass out. You know, it's just going to happen. Wham, no, it's not programmed. Didn't know where and what I might do. Couldn't predict then with any accuracy what might happen after I started drinking. Couldn't make this prediction. Didn't know what was going to happen. Had to drink. Couldn't stop. Wanted to stop. Not for always, just for that week, you know. Man, you know, like make the funerals anyhow, you know. Couldn't do it. Anything big that came up, you know, had to get drunk. Couldn't face it. I didn't understand it. Didn't get better. It got worse. Church people come by and say, Dupree, what you ought to do now is ask God to help you. That's something to think about. And ask God to help you. Be certain if you ever give anybody the instruction that God will help them, make certain they know who God is. You might have to demonstrate in your own life who God is so these people will have sufficient faith, just like you have demonstrated to me in AA, who God was. A God of love, God of understanding, a God with tremendous love and tremendous compassion and forgiveness. See? And I didn't know who God was, so I couldn't ask him for help. See? I thought if we resumed our correspondence and communication, it would just further my visit to hell. I mean, you know, I didn't want to go there. I loved me. I didn't want to burn up. Well, you know, finally you got to go to the hospital, right? I've been hospitalized 42 times for drug addiction and alcoholism. And I'm going to talk about alcohol and drugs and God. And it's the three important things, and it takes a good while to talk about either one. 42 times. Been in the state hospital twice, sitting right there in the middle of the room as the old boy I was in the state hospital with one time. Man, he was in one section, I was in the other section. I could see him through the bars, he could see me, you know. Suffering, hurting. Like the speaker said last night, that hurting that I had and didn't have nobody to tell it to. That first time in that state hospital where I had to go because I was temporarily insane because of the use of alcohol, they had to take me. Poor little old wife driving the car, you know, and me on the back seat with my trunks and top coat and electric razor and everything, daddy on the front seat holding his hand. His head hanging down. Shame, you know. Shame, yes, shame. Taking my oldest son to the asylum, as he called it, you know. And that's a pitiful sight, you know. And I get there and I got on my gray suit all right. Yes, sir. I had it on for 2 or 3 weeks. It was dirty. They told me I got in there, you know, I didn't weigh but about 125 pounds. I hadn't eaten in a couple of months. Just drink, 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 having to drink and couldn't drink. And they were taking me up there, and I was too weak and too sick to resist, you know. And got me in there, and they carried me into this place. I'm going to just share just a little bit with you. They went in there and said, take off your clothes, Mr. Westbury, and take a bath. I needed a bath. You know, you've heard comments about this week, too, about, you know, how we smell and, you know. So I needed a bath, and I took off my clothes and took a bath. And they came up to me with this smock-like deal that you put on women in a maternity ward and stuck out my arms, and they slipped it over and said, turn around, Mr. Westbury, we're tied in the back. But they fumbled around a little bit, and I went to walk it off, and they hadn't tied it in the back, because I could feel all that cool air back there, you know, on me. And led me out into a sun porch, into an area of suffering humanity that I cannot describe. Alcoholics on the left, with their backs to the wall, scared to death, watching everybody, you know. Just watching. On the right, with the religious fanatics, praying and singing out of Life magazine, you know. In the middle with a psycho patient, jumping over one table and going under the next one and hitting each other in the head with chairs and doing their regular daily gymnastics. Old Dupree said, there, that's my bunch right over there, with their backs to the wall watching. And I went over and joined them. Alcoholics have always been together. We in this room have always been together. Whether we were at the Red Rooster drinking Budweiser, puking on somebody, or whether we were in that old insane hospital together, or whether we find ourselves together in the blessed fellowship of AA, we have always been together in one or the other place. And I finally got out of there, and they gave me shots on this side, one on each side every 4 hours. And I got where I couldn't sit down. I couldn't even get into bed. And I wasn't just past 30 years old. And I was young. I said, this is terrible. Dupree, when you get out of here, if you can't remember not to go in the liquor store again, you just stick this in and it'll tell you to get out. You know, hurting all over. And when I got out of that state hospital, I used both ends and I stayed sober 9 months. What is the first thing that I needed to do when I got out of there? I needed to do what is suggested in the AA program. I needed to make amends. But I didn't know how to make amends properly. I didn't know how to do that. I knew what I had deprived my family of, and in order to replace this with love, I was thinking in the terms of material things, and still do too much sometimes today. So I got me a job and went to work immediately to be self-supporting and to buy things for my family so they would be happy and forgive Daddy. And I got to be right successful. I tell this because it was important in my life. I traded nickels with my brother. We got a nickel a week once a month. And we used to go to town and one would give the other a nickel to make a dime to go look at the movie, you know, and sit around all day Sunday and talk about them cowboys and fellas and them cows and playing them guitars and things. And I swore with a great deal of loyalty and obsession that if I ever got to be a grown man, I was going to make a lot of money and get rich and get happy, you know. And I started in this pursuit. And the year after I came out of this hospital, the times that I was sober, my income was $2,000 to $3,000 a week, from a nickel a week to this, you know. And we've discussed here this weekend how many of the people around and about in Georgia went to Mercer, you know, and got to be alcoholics. But I mean, I was just born smart, and I was just waiting on an opportunity. I didn't have to go to school. And there I was, you know, with this opportunity to work and to make money and to get happy, and I did that. And I did real well in this job, and I took on a second job. And I did real well in it, and I took on yet a third job. And neither one of the three companies knew that I was working for the other company. This did not produce anything but delayed my ability to get sober. I can't think of anything in the world any worse than a fellow like me, a full-blown alcoholic, now having plenty of money. So I got drunk in August following my discharge from the state sanatorium in November of the past year. And when I got on this drunk, I had $50,000 cash money in the bank. And I didn't sober up until, this was in Labor Day, and I didn't sober up until the following Easter. And I had gone through many institutions with wall-to-wall ceiling, wall-to-wall carpet, you know, and I'd go in and ask Mr. Westbury what he wanted, you know. Not what he needed. What do you want? What you been taking there? And I'd tell her, you cannot get sober in places that do not have a success story, you know. This is why AA is so successful, because we deal with the answer to the illness. And these people were dealing with the problem just to get me sober and get me out. And a doctor one day told me, said, Mr. Westbury, I can help you. I'll teach you hypnosis, and you can go into a mental trance, and while you're in this trance for 8 minutes, you'll get the equivalent of 8 hours rest, and casually suggest to yourself that you not take another drink. Isn't that good news for the suffering alcoholic? Ain't that good news for me? And wouldn't it have been good news for you if somebody would have told you that they could get you into a trance and tell you not to ever drink again and you would never drink again? Wouldn't that be good news? And I went home and told the wife, you know, because she had showed me those marks on her face where I had hit her while I was drunk. And I had seen those little blue marks on the children's head where I had slapped them. And the dog would come to me one evening, and the next evening he wouldn't, because I was just liable to kick him. It's not, you know, love him 1 minute and kick him the next. Unpredictable. The illness of alcoholism is a family thing. It should be a family recovery. I could see those children of mine with strained emotions of anxiety and frustration look around the corner when I would come home in the evening, you know, and just burst into the greatest smile once they thought Daddy was sober and all right, but withdraw if they saw him in another condition. When you were like that, wouldn't you like to be sober? So I told this fella, I said, man, I want to be sober. Yeah, I'll do anything. And it don't make no difference how much it costs, because I got plenty of money. That's alcoholic too. And he didn't care how much it cost either. I mean, he started charging me accordingly. And he said, now, Mr. Westbury, come on in and lay down. You are extremely nervous. You ever see an alcoholic was extremely nervous? Lay down. And he tied that arm off, you know, with that rubber tube, and he stuck me with 7 grains of sodium amytal. He said, now, Mr. Westbury, when I get you just a little bit relaxed, would you please raise your finger and I'll stop the injection, because we want you to look at this blue light and concentrate and do these mental gymnastics which is necessary for you to go into the trance. And when he put that thing in my arm and it started to go in all over my body, he was giving me something that I needed. Dope, my drug, in a different form. And I ain't raised that finger till yet. Oh, he gave it to me, and I passed out and laid there like a dead hog in the sunshine. Finally, I woke up and looked at him. I said, Doc, you have to do it again, because it didn't work that time. Lie, lie, lie. What do people like I do that have find a chemical, a drug that'll help me with my illness? I'll lie about it, and I'll use it. And I did this. Finally, he taught me just a little bit of hypnosis, you know. Big shot doctor. It wasn't, you know, one of these average fellas. Big shot doctor. I wouldn't go no average doctor. He wouldn't appreciate me. But anyway, he said, look at the blue light and breathe in and out 3 dozen times. And after you've done this, your eyes will be cemented shut. And I can stick a pin through your left wrist and you won't even know it. And I'll press you gently on your left shoulder, and you will awake. And in the interim time, I'll suggest that you never take another drink, and you won't. And you go home with these news, you know, and the family's waiting. Well, what did he say? Honey, I got good news for you. The doctor's helping me. Today, he stuck a thing through my hand, and I didn't even know it. She said, I wish I could sometime. But how does it work? I didn't have a metronome in the house, you know, what, click, click, click. Go in the kitchen and get the biscuit pan and bring it here and sit down by me on the sofa and turn the TV over there to channel 9. Ain't no picture on it. And I'm going to watch the TV. This is going to be my blue light. I want you to start beating on the biscuit pan, honey, with a rhythm. Beat on the biscuit pan. Now watch me look at the TV. Now watch me breathe in on a click and out on a click, and before I have done this 2 dozen times, I'll go into a trance, and my eyes will be as if they were cemented shut. And then by the time I've done this 3 dozen times, suggest to me that I don't drink again, and I won't. And she beat on the paint. This is really pitiful, isn't it?
This displays to the best form I know the total insanity that we're involved with the illness and with the family itself. Beating on the pan and me looking at the TV set. Everybody hoping, you know. No human power will relieve your alcoholism. It's the instruction you get. But I thought it would. I wanted it too. I wanted to be sober. Oh, so many of us will go to doctors these days, and thank God the doctors do have more knowledge about this thing, and they do understand, and they treat us like we ought to be treated, so many of them. Thank God for this. But you know, you can go to the doctor, and a lot of times you can get all types of advice, you know. Like the old boy down home went to the doctor, and he went to the psychiatrist, and after a round with him, the psychiatrist said, well, I got bad news for you, but then I got good news for you, too. The old boy said, well, I reckon you better give me the bad news first. And the psychiatrist looked at him, and he said, you're right on the borderline of becoming a quit. The old boy said, well, that is something. He said, well, what's the good news? He said, I think you're cute as hell. You know? Well, I mean, we go sometimes, we want to get advice, and we don't know what we're getting into. One of these places I mentioned was Lexington, Kentucky. My federally appointed prison number in the U.S. Public Health Hospital in Lexington is 66777. Full house. Ain't that good? Full house. They gave me that number when I went to Lexington July the 3rd of 1962. They said, Mr. Westbury, you'll have this number for as long as you live. Because you are a Class A narcotics addict, and a barbiturate addict, an amphetamine addict, and we don't ever see many of these people get sober. And you'll be coming back here many times. And this number will always be your number. And we're not going to let anybody else have it. And we'll put it on the front of this blue folder, and it will always be yours. And every time you come back, Mr. Westbury, we'll just write another chapter in that book. Everywhere I went, people told me that I would not get sober. That's real interesting, isn't it? Because it proves that people aren't in charge of sobriety. From this conclusion, you can come to your own that God is. Because no one thought I'd make it, you know. And I spent 4 months out there, and I shall never forget that as long as I live. I needed to go back, but when it was time to go back again, the snow was on the ground, and the hospital was full, and I couldn't get in. And they didn't give me any priority. They just said, if you come as a volunteer and there's a bed, you can have it. So I had to go elsewhere. But I never shall forget going in this hospital and watching these other people like myself. You know, in institutions, when clocks get to, say, 4 o'clock, if all of the clocks in the institution aren't right on the money, they'll jump back 2 or 3 minutes, and all of them would set themselves automatically, see? And it was almost time for our dope. And this is what we lived for, our dope. And we would line up talking about being humble. I know about being humble. Get in that little stall and wait for that cart to come by, and that old mean nurse would look down the line and say, all right, get in your holes there if you want it. And back in your hole and stand there and wait for them to come by with your dope, you know. And one little boy, a Jewish boy there, wasn't even 20 years old, was watching that clock. In just a few minutes, it would be 4 o'clock and time to get our dope. And we had waited 20 years for the next dose of dope. And that clock got to 4 o'clock, and it jumped back 3 minutes, you know, to adjust itself. And that boy grabbed his shoe off and went up there and destroyed the face of that clock in one blow. He thought the clock was going back the other way, that he wouldn't get his dope. I could talk to you until tomorrow afternoon, and I could talk to you about the hell of the addiction of drugs, and I could not convey to you, because I do not have the sufficient capacity or adjectives to describe the hell of drug addiction. You go out into a hell that has no boundaries and are suspended there. For that first shot of dope that you take, oh, it makes you grow tall and gives you tremendous compassion, and you can look down at people like God with a great deal of love and with wisdom. But that moment comes when you can't get no more, and you've got to be pulled off of it. And minutes become 5 years long. And it's 25 years from this day until the next day. And you hurt in a torturing, racking way which I cannot describe to you. And I heard dogs howling up there in that hospital, and I said, what is this? And they said, Dr. Isbell, the world famous scientist, is doing research down in the basement. Would you like to see? And I said, I would. And they carried me down there, and I saw rows of rooms where people just like me would volunteer to receive huge doses of dope so that they could observe them locked in these rooms. And then they would quit the dope, you know, and then watch them as they withdrew and record their physical and mental reaction. And down a little farther were the dogs, come up and stick out their arms, paw for a shot of dope in that joint. And a little bit farther, rats like will run these girls up on the stool in the kitchen, you know, take a nickel pencil and throw it there, and whoom, it's gone, man. Rat done eat it up. Rats don't eat pencils. Character changing drug. And hey, I'm now an alcoholic, and I'm also a dope addict, and people tell me I ain't gonna get sober, and I stand here tonight, I am sober. I should be grateful. Gratitude is my greatest deficiency. It's that I think of most of us, not being grateful enough. Not being grateful enough. Oh, every day, you know, I would love to be good, but I don't want to be good all the time. How about you? And even these days that I don't want to be good, God allows me to be sober. I'm a dope addict, and I'm an alcoholic, and I'm sober. I ought to be grateful, and I am grateful to you. And I lose everything, and I'm to mama's. We got to go somewhere. And they'll give me a dollar every now and then, and I'll go downtown and get a pack of Camel cigarettes for 30 cents and a 69 cents bottle of Vitalik hair tonic, and come home and take that plastic bottle and squeeze it out in a glass and go in the bathroom and drink damn near all of it. I'm sorry, Virginia. But leave about that much in the bottle and put it on my hair, you know, and so I'll smell like I just been to the barbershop, and drink the rest of it. Because I ain't got no money, and I can't get no dope. And them thousands of dollars is gone, and my wife is gone, and my young'uns is gone. And I ain't got no reason to live, and I don't want to live. And I've tried to die, and I've tried to kill myself, and I wish I was dead. And I wake up in the morning, and I'm still there, I'm still alive, I'm still sick, and I'm still suffering. Still sick and still suffering. And I was sitting on the porch one night, looking out into the darkness of nowhere, hoping for nothing, wishing for nothing, just didn't want to be there. And Mama comes out on the porch and looks at me and says this, now y'all, things is fixing to get better right now. Dupree, Mary wants you to go with them to them meeting. Mary is my Al-Anon sponsor. Like another fellow that had a lot of success in this world, Mary and Joseph are my sponsors, along with many others that I've accumulated. What was my first reaction when Mama said this? I turned around and I looked at her and I said, why does she give a damn about me? Quote. This is so hard to understand. When we're suffering and somebody sends word, come and go with me, I want to help you. This is not logical, see? And I've been used to doing things logically. I called them and told them I would go with them to the meeting. You know, so many times we go from AA to make a 12-step call and we walk in the house and we look down there on the front row and the old boy's on the front, you know, room, and he's laying there on the bed, half on and half off, about dead. You know, we walk in and we say, "Wake up there, buddy, we got good news for you. I'm from AA," you know. "I come to help you." The next time you do this, you walk in and do this. "Hey there, buddy, I'm from BB. I come to help you." He's just as glad to see you. But boy, I go in there and I tell him, "I'm from AA. You want to see my chip? You know, I come to help you. Things going to be better." I didn't expect this type of help. If I had gone to an "I come to help you," the next time you do this, you walk in and do this. "Hey there, buddy, I'm from BB. I come to help you." He's just as glad to see you. But boy, I go in there and I tell him, "I'm from AA. You want to see my chip? You know, I come to help you. Things going to be better." I didn't expect this type of help. If I had gone to an AA meeting, wouldn't it have been proper if my wife had bought a new station wagon and packed some sandwiches and something to drink and got the kids together and come and got me and Mom and Daddy and we all went together? Now, wouldn't that have been the appropriate way to go to my first AA meeting? But man, it don't work like that. See, God is fixing to help me now, and God don't do things logically, see? I mean, you can't say, "Well, it's 12 o'clock, 4 o'clock, and I'm half through work, and 8 o'clock I'm going to get off." I mean, you can't program what God's fixing to do for you. And I went to that meeting, and when the meeting was over with, they said, "In this group, we've got a chip system. And if you want to do something about your drinking, you come up and get a chip." And I went and got one just like that. I had been in that Baptist church where the preacher said if you didn't come shake his hand, you'd go to hell. And I'd wait till they got down to the fourth stanza before I went. But when they offered that white chip in the Wallabug group, I run down and got it. They said, "We want you to come up there and get it because we want to know if you want help. And this is your acknowledgement that you want help." And then we start giving you help like some of these fellas started pretty quick. Why, you can't balk, you know. Admit that you're an alcoholic and that you want help. Don't go dragging up there after the meeting and get it. I ain't never been for that. I ain't never carried nobody old chip home and give it to them. And I started to go into AA. And you started your instruction. And I had studied Socrates and Marcus Aurelius and Plato and all of the known knowledgeable people. And I knew a lot of things. I had some wisdom, I thought, you know. But you know what my first instructions were when I came to AA? And these still very good instructions. Simply don't take the first drink. Don't take the first drink and you won't get drunk. I found out what alcoholism was. I found out if I took the first drink, I couldn't stop then. This compulsion would set in and I would have no choice. They also told me if I had any trouble to call one of them, and I believed them. Call us if you need help. Man, ain't nobody offered me no help in no long time now, you know. And I get help offers. What's happening? People who care and wanted to share, and people who loved me, people who understood me wanted to help. And we started to talking about these steps, and they used to ask me what I thought about them. And for 3 months, I wouldn't say nothing. Can you imagine that? Their thing. I thought that I would wake up, you know, again yet one more time in an institution, and I would be there. And I would be hung over again because I had been sober some periods, you know, for a little while. And I was almost afraid, but yet I knew that I need not be afraid of AA. I was told, "If Dupree come, you don't have to be afraid of this. You'll understand it as you experience it." AA is not a program of knowledge, but a program of experience.
and experience one day at a time, it'll get better. And it did get better. It did get better. I had hope when I came to AA. This is what you and I need to display to the new people that come today. You are in the right place because there's hope and there's help for you. Because, see, there is something we can do for the suffering alcoholic. There wasn't any question in these people's minds about me staying sober one day at a time. They said, you can do it. You ask God to help you. Went on, I didn't have no trouble with the second step. I had been back to that insane asylum yet another time. No problem there. I did have a problem when I got to the third step. Turned my life over to God. Oh, get burnt up, not me. I ain't gonna do that. But you know, by this time I had been in AA a while. And I had changed. My attitude had changed. Thinking had changed, you know. Kind of like the old boy down home was riding through town and he seen this pretty girl standing there on the corner. He stopped his car and said, I'm going to give you a ride. And she said, okay, and she got in. They were riding along and he looked at her and said, golly, you pretty. So I'm going to stop this car and kiss you. She said, no, don't do that. I'm a witch. He said, phooey, I don't believe in the witch stories, changing horses into rats into horses and pumpkins into golden chariots, but I don't believe it. Them witch stories. And she said, believe it or not, but I am a witch. So they rode a little farther down the road, and he looked at her, and she was pretty. And he stopped the car and kissed her. And she turned him into a motel. Right there. And I had come to AA, and I didn't want to get turned into nothing. I had just come because I wanted to quit shaking and puking, that's all. But I was being turned into something, you know, because I was following your path. I copied things that you did. Oh, I used to copy Cornel. I didn't much care about cigars, but I started smoking them, and I bought him some. They wasn't worth a count, but I'd buy them and give them to it. I wanted to, and Harry and all these people just helped me so much, you know. I'd do what you used to do. You could pull out a chair for some girl to sit down. I'd pull out one to sit down, you know. Copy, you know. It's a program of mental imprint and copy and follow this path. And I was following your path because I wanted to be sober. But yet these other things were changing, these bonuses. These things were happening to me. And I hadn't been warned about that. If somebody would have told me when I went to AA and got my white chip that I'd have been dressed up and sober tonight and had a pretty wife like Evelyn, I wouldn't have believed it, man. I'd have run. Well, what in the world would I need with yet another woman, huh? Back in them days, I didn't. So they were very wise in telling me about the things I needed to know first. First things first, you know. And then I learned about God through you. Learned who God was. Learned that God loved me. Learned that I could understand him, I could accept him as I understood him. And the only understanding I had of him was from the exemplary form that you carried about in your daily life. And I could understand that. But this wasn't all, you know, like, as you understand him, I have yet another step further down the line that give me the opportunity to seek through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God. I could improve this understanding I had. I could improve this knowledge that I had about him and what he could do for me. And then I had the opportunity to find out what I could do for him. A lot of people missed the boat right there. What I could do for him. Working these steps, you know, they benefit you so much in your personal life. And after you get into a good AA group, and all of you are from good AA groups, then sometime you talk about them traditions, you know. Our personal recovery depends on AA unity. Go to the group and do your part and don't criticize. Let live, live and let live, you know. Them rules to live by yourself, them rules for the group to live by. Lord, that's been a hard road for some people, you know. I have always wanted AA to flourish and flower and grow. So people like me who had a blue book where the number in front could come. Knowingly, I have never done anything in my life to destroy anything that AA has created or to retard its growth. God forgive me if I have. I had always been like this, you know, ready for people to forgive and to forgive myself. You know what I mean? Lord, it's so hard for me to say I'm sorry. You all know Evelyn, don't you? That's the reason I'm over here. They invited Evelyn, and my talking is just incidental. Evelyn's a Georgia girl, a beautiful thing that I have grown to love even more recently. We know each other better now, you know. We courted kind of like, you know, under the auspices of AA, to AA meeting. This is not a fair situation to court under. You know, but we did. And she told me when we were courting, said, if you want what I got, there are certain steps you must take. And one of them was getting married, so we married, I mean. I come in one night, you know, and Evelyn was standing at the back door ready to kiss me. Let me tell you just a little bit about this. Linnea said the other night, and happy 21st anniversary to you and Barbara. Said the other night, you know, he'd been in age 5.5 years, never had got invited to talk to a place like this. I bought me an airplane, and so when I got invited to talk to retreats like this, I'd have a way to go. Never did get invited. I sold airplane and then got invited, you know. But anyway, Evelyn's standing there at the back door and waiting to kiss me when I come in. And those of you who have loved her before I had the opportunity know what she is. And I'm standing there, she wants to kiss when I come in, and I'm had a bad day. See, I'm the boss of my company. I mean, when you get to me, that's as far as you go. I'm chairman of the board. That's it. And my fellas ain't doing what I told them to do, and I come in, and I'm upset, and she's wanting to kiss, and I said, what in the devil have we got going here? You some sex maniac or something, you know? And keep getting it right on back to the bathroom, and got back there and realized, took that inventory again. You know, so many people don't do that. And I thank God my instructions were to take that inventory, and when I was wrong, properly admit it. Now, I don't do this often, but I want to cite this one case where I did. I said, I shouldn't have done that. I'm going to ask her to forgive me. And I went and got my most beautiful antique bottle and went out in the yard and cut a rose and put in that bottle and wrote Evelyn a note. Dear Evelyn, I love you and I'm sorry I said this. And I went in the house back at the kitchen where she was, Ferris, and I put the rose down in the vase and the note, and Evelyn come over and looked at it and picked it up and read it and she... I love you, too. Hard to say I'm sorry. Do you all find it hard to ask people for forgiveness? These two girls were walking down the street back home one day, and one of them looked at the other and said, Lord, you look like you in the mother fashion. She says, I am. I'm going to be a mother. She said, well, do you know who the father is? And she said, yeah. I said, well, who is it? She said, it's John. Well, what did John say when you told him? He said, excuse me. So many times when we do wrong, all we got to do is just walk up and say, forgive me or excuse me. You know what I mean? That's all the program says we have to do. But you know, it doesn't stop here. You got to give me some water. I've been bad on that drinking all my life. Ain't gonna be long now. Okay, I'm sober. And I know about God. And I know God's instructions for me. The knowledge of His will for me and the power to carry that out. And I've heard so many times this instruction in the preamble. Our primary purpose in AA is to stay sober and to carry the message to the suffering alcoholic. And I, just like you, knew many people that were suffering alcoholics. And for this time in my life, and just recently, I've had the opportunity to go and to tell people about AA, and to get them in hospitals, and get them out of hospitals, and carry them to their first meet. An old buddy of mine was home drunk. This is a true story, and he asked me to tell you this. One night I was talking in Aiken, South Carolina, and I brought this up, and I hadn't asked John's permission. And John said, Uncle Duke, that's what he called me. He said, Uncle Duke, if you ever want to tell people about me, why, you do it. You got my permission. So I got his permission. And I'm going to talk just a little bit now on sponsorship and what we're supposed to do in AA after God grants us sobriety. What he wants us to do for him. So I went out to see old John, and I stopped at this filling station. This woman said, where are you going, Dupree? I said, I'm going out to see John. She said, don't go out there. Ooh, you sober now, and you got a pretty wife and a pretty home. Don't go out there and let him get you drunk again, because you know how it was. You all used to get drunk and shoot at people because they wouldn't push you out the ditch. Don't you remember? But I went anyway. I love John. We grew up together. When he was 16 years old, we went on our first date together. He furnished his daddy's car, and I furnished the gas and the chewing gum. When the leaves were off the trees in the country, I could look through there and see the light at John's house, and he could see it at my house. We went to our first mud hole together, fishing in anticipation, and grew up with the same hopes in life that the other shared. The hopes that someday happiness, the reality of all of this would be ours, and John was out there drunk, and I was sober. And I went to see him, and I said, listen, you come and go with me to these AA meetings, and you'll make it. It won't be necessary for you to drink again. I knew John wanted to be sober. It says in this how it works, if we are willing to go to any length. Yeah. John had been willing before this. We used to be bird hunting together, you know, and he'd look at me and said, Uncle Duper, I tell you what, if I catch you drinking again, I'm going to shoot you. And if you catch me drinking, you shoot me. See? And this boy was an expert bird shot, see? And I was better than he was. Jim Pilcher calls that egotistical humility. But anyway, this is willing to get sober, you know. And I knew he was suffering. Just a few months prior to that, he had been discharged dishonorably from the Army, from guarding our nation in the missile silos in Cheyenne, Wyoming. This brilliant man, this friend of mine, was home drunk with his vulgar self. But sick, don't go out there. He's so mean and so nasty. But when you felt like I felt, so good in your heart and sober and happy and wanting to do something for God, you can't stay home. And I went on out and told him. And John became a member of AA immediately upon the suggestion to him. An associate member. Used to come to the eating meeting and the birthday parties. He didn't come to the closed meetings or nothing like this, you know. Just them special deals, you know. He wouldn't take no chip. He said, Uncle Duke, if I'm ever sober a year, I want one of them blue ones. I said, okay. You don't have to take a white one because it ain't in the big book. And if it ain't in the big book, it ain't. But in this group, we suggest that you take one. But if you don't want to take one, it's all right. As an associate member, he stayed sober for a while. And then he got drunk. And locked up and drunk again and locked up and drunk again and locked up, you know. And I'm trying to sponsor him. I'm bringing him to AA. I'm going to show him. I'm going to let him walk in my path. The next time you feel like that, you go in and get somebody and bring them to AA and sponsor them, be certain that you got sufficient patience and courage and time and love. It takes all of them. But he got on the chain gang, and he stayed on the chain gang 2 or 3 weeks. And I wrote him a letter one day. I said, Dear John, if you want to get sober, now here's what you got to do. One, you got to quit drinking, because that was the first instruction I had. Quit drinking. Second, you got to stop living with that woman you're living with, because she ain't your wife, you know. You got to quit that old ugly talk and come go with me to them meetings. And he's in a ditch, and he's digging with them striped britches on, you know. This missile expert in a ditch digging. And his pride would not allow him to answer my letter and ask for help. Cunning, baffling, and powerful alcoholism was killing my friend. And all I could do was wait. And one day I got this letter. Come get me, Uncle Dupe. I'll do anything. Boy, we load up a car full of AAs and go get him, you know. And bring him home and take them old stripes off it. He ain't got nowhere to live because his house is burned down. But he got a tenant house out on this beautiful farm he owns. Said, Uncle Duke, I'm willing to do anything now. I said, well, where you gonna live? He says, I live in the chimney of this old, in the kitchen of this old big home, you know. And I cook down in the chimney, but I need a cot and a pan and a kerosene lamp. And we go and we collect these things from the house and from mothers, and we set up John the housekeeping. One quilt, one pillow, one cot, one black frying pan, and a little daily dole of cigarettes and groceries. And John went to the closed meeting. John went to the open meeting. John went to the discussion meeting. Anywhere I suggested go, he went. One night he asked us to come to his place for dinner, to his house there. He had found an old table on a trash pile, and somebody had given him some chairs, and Evelyn had told him that we would cook. And Evelyn cooked for 2 or 3 days. This is a true story. And filled up a great big old basket full of good food, and we went out to John's house and knocked on the door. And John came and said, come in. And he took the basket and went in and put a tablecloth that Evelyn had carried and lit a candle and spread out all the food and then come back to the door and said, come on in, Uncle Duke, have dinner with me. A real fellowship is AA. And we thank God for being sober that day and thank God for the food and ate and got up and went to a meeting. See, this happened in my life. I'm telling you the truth. He never did pick up a, you know, one of them red chips for 3 months like it is over home, one of them 6 month chips which is yellow. Just keep right on staying sober. People said he wouldn't stay sober. You know what I mean? I was so proud of him. Oh, I was about to bust. You know, one night I was laying there at the house, too, and I couldn't sleep. I just couldn't sleep that night. I had gone to the meeting the night before, and somebody had insulted me something about the coffee. And I said, about making the coffee. And, you know, I looked at him, and I said, well, I'll be damned. You know, I'll go to St. George, and I'll start me my own group. And I'll call it the Saint Group. And you people what don't like me can die and go to hell. I'll pick out the ones that love me and let them join my group. You can't sleep when you're thinking like that. And I'm laying there, and I ain't asleep, and I'm thinking them old bad thoughts, see? And the telephone rings about 3 o'clock in the morning and said, you Dupree Westbury, and I said, I am. They said, your buddy, John, has had a heart attack, and he is dying. He will be dead when you get to the hospital. The first thing that registered was I had never yet talked to my buddy about God, you know. Had done all these preliminary things, but had never gotten right down there and talked to him about God. I rushed right on up there, and he didn't die. Laying up under that oxygen tent, that old monitor going everywhere, you know. Old Booger was still living. I said, man, if he ever gets to where I can talk to him about God, I'm going to tell him. When he come to, he looked at me and said, Uncle Dupe, I'm glad to see you. When you come to see me again, would you bring me some fried squash? I said, certainly I will. I went home and I asked Evelyn, I said, cook John some fried squash. She said, Dupree, heart patients don't need fried squash. I said, I don't care what they need. Cook. And she's a good Al-Anon, and she cooked. And I went back to the hospital with that dish in my hand, covered up with tinfoil, and I stopped to the nurse's desk. And I said, I'm Dupree Westbury, and I'm a friend of John's, and my wife is a registered nurse. And she fixed this dish for him, and she knows what to fix for heart patients. If I love you, I'll lie for you right tonight. And I remember going, Uncle Dupe, I want me a cigarette now. Okay. Got him out from under that cover, you know, with all them old wires hooked onto him, and carried him in the bathroom, let him smoke one, and then slipped him back under there. Loved him. By the time I got ready to go, this little dried-up fella come walking in the door and said, hi, how you doing? My name is Frank Myers, and I'm the Methodist minister from Bowman, South Carolina, and I came by to talk to you. And was just about to leave when John's arm shot out from under the cover and said, pray for me before you go, please. Pray for me, preacher. And the preacher looked at him and said, why don't you pray for yourself? And he said, I have never prayed to God in my life. I wouldn't know how to do it. He said, but you must have some idea, and the time to start is now. And John prayed his first prayer to God. And I witnessed this. Took out his book and turned to Romans 10:9. Whosoever calleth on the name of the Lord shall be saved. And shut the book and said, it's just that simple, John. And I was so joyous inside. And I rushed home and Evelyn was asleep. And I got over to bed and woke her up. Wake up, honey. John knows about God. And we got up and we celebrate. John knows about God. Dupree Westbury is sober. And he got God, and his buddy is sober, and he got God. Now, ain't that a good thing? He told me one day, go help this woman in town. She needs help. I said, are you recovering from this heart attack? You go help her. You got plenty of time. October the 5th, 1967, after he had been sober 17 months, he come walking into this meeting with this old, ugly, crippled-up woman, you know, could hardly go. He wouldn't have spit on this day or so a year from that day because of his pride. And he comes in with this ugly old soul and bringing her to the meeting. And it was a eating meeting, and he stayed so long he didn't get time to eat, but he wanted to bring her to the meeting. She sit down over there by Evelyn, and John come over there and sit down by me, and when he give out the chip, she got up and got one. And Evelyn didn't pinch it because I was sitting where I could watch. And after the meeting was over, John come over to me and Evelyn and said, you know what I could do? I said, no. I'm coming home next week. I'm coming back out to the farm next week. You know what he meant to say? Come by in the morning and come by in the evening and let's talk and let's fellowship and let's share and let's care. I said, okay, I'll see you Monday. And Saturday evening at 2 o'clock, I was watching my color TV set, and my favorite football team was losing. In a few minutes' time, I would get up and go to the Baptist College to hear Al Hurt blow his trumpet, thinking no AA thoughts, thinking about nothing in particular, just sitting there. And the telephone rang and said, this Bree Westbury? I said, yeah. We want you to be the first one to know. You saved him. Your buddy, John, come home while I go to bring his clothes. And when he backed out of the yard, he died. And he's out in the field. A car ran on out in the field. And he's lying there across the steering wheel, and he's dead. And because you helped save him, we wanted you to know. I didn't save him. God had done it through you. And I went out, and my buddy was dead. And we carried him to town and prepared to bury him. And the next day, they came up to me at the funeral home, the sister and the brother-in-law, and they had a blue chip in their hand. And they said, Dupree, we probably think that you would like to have this back, because we remember on July 17th last year when you give it to him. Here's this chip. And I took it and walked over and put it in my buddy's pocket. And we buried John. The fellow that people said wasn't worth a damn. He had 17 months of sobriety. That's AA for you. That's AA. Getting sober and doing God's will. Trying to help another alcoholic. Trying to do what God wants us to do. Nothing will give you the happiness, the warm, good feeling, it says in the book, big book, as working with others. There's plenty of people back in your hometown that people have said wasn't worth a damn. If you wanted to leave here tonight and go home and find a John to work with, you could certainly find one. God bless you, and I love you.
Share, got a blessing from his message, and I don't see why he don't go ahead and be a Baptist preacher later. And I goofed up so to start with, I'm going to try not to goof up the closing. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.